Seldom a week passes without some mention in the news of troubles in our country's higher education system. The issues with public higher ed are well known in both our states. Lower state support, fewer course and program offerings, and much higher tuition. But our states are not the only ones. And there are issues with cost and efficiency and much more in all of higher education. Those issues are laid out neatly in the book Degrees of Inequality, How the Politics of Higher Education Sabotage the American Dream. Suzanne Mettler is the author. She is a professor of American institutions at Cornell University and a fellow at the Century Foundation. Her earlier book is The Submerged State, How Invisible Government Policies Undermine American Democracy. Suzanne Mettler, thanks so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, thank you, Jeffrey. I'm delighted to be with you.
So what is the Century Foundation and what do you do as a fellow?
Oh, the Century Foundation is a think tank that's based in New York City, and they have some resident fellows. I'm a non-resident fellow, and we're all people who are engaged in work about how government can make a difference, and they help to promote our work.
So the book Degrees of Inequality begins with a vignette in Congress, and you write, get right to the point about the politics of higher education hinted at in the subtitle there. What was this discussion about with Congress and for-profit colleges several years ago?
Oh, right. Well, this is a really surprising vignette that I started the book with. We know that today we are in the most polarized time in modern history in terms of how the two parties get along in Congress. They're further apart on most issues than has been the case in at least a century. And that, you know, really interferes with most kinds of policymaking. But I found, to my surprise, that there are some areas of public policy where there is real bipartisanship. And one of these was around support for the for-profit colleges. And it's not the case in the U.S. Senate, but it is in the U.S. House of Representatives, that Democrats and Republicans across the aisle, ranging from, you know, Tea Party Republicans to liberal Democrats, will vote together to support the industry of the for-profit colleges. And this happened on a few occasions in recent years during President Obama's first term, when the Department of Education was trying to come up with new rules to regulate the for-profit colleges and the conditions under which they need to operate if they're going to receive federal aid. And many members of the House didn't like that, and so they voted on several occasions to suggest that it shouldn't be happening.
So I was surprised to see that. I mean, this is one of the first big surprises in Degrees of Inequality, that a big chunk of the income for the for-profit universities comes from public, therefore taxpayer sources. How big a chunk is that?
It's a very big chunk. The for-profit colleges are allowed by law to receive up to 90% of their revenues from the federal government and actually from just one public policy, and that is the Higher Education Act's Title IV. That includes student loans and Pell Grants and so on. So the 90% figure doesn't even include the money they're allowed to get from the federal government over and above that, for example, from the post-9/11 GI Bill and other military education programs. So as it turns out, the top 15 for-profit colleges, which are all publicly traded on Wall Street, and these are big multi-state corporations like the University of Phoenix and so on, they receive, on average, 86% of their revenues from the federal government.
But through things like student loans, or is it a more direct payment?
Also from Pell Grants, and as well, and the GI Bill.
So have you formulated your own opinion about whether the for-profit colleges are good for higher education and students of higher education or not?
Well, the data are very sobering. And, you know, of course, in any sector, I'm sure there's real variation. And no doubt there are some schools out there, maybe some smaller programs, that are doing a good job by their students. But when you look at the data compared to other sectors, it's very worrisome. Only about 22% of their students graduate, compared to well over 50% or 60% in the other sectors of higher education. And these students, to attend, nearly all of them take out student loans. So it's about 94% of all of those who actually finish with a bachelor's degree who've taken out a loan. And the amount that they borrow is staggering. It's about $33,000 for the median student. Now, we have to look carefully when we talk about student loans. There's been a lot of publicity lately about how students in college generally are borrowing a lot of money. But you have to ask yourself the question, well, how much did they borrow and where did they get their degree and did they graduate? Because if you go to some schools where you're going to get a really great education and you borrow some money to do it, that really counts as a great investment. It was well worth it to borrow some money in order to do that. But when it comes to the for-profit colleges, it seems in many cases to have not been a good investment. And we can assess that by the fact that their default rates are so high. Their students account for nearly half of all defaults on student loans, despite the fact that there are only about 1 in 10 American college students who attend the for-profit.
All right, so graduation rates low, loan default rates high. We're not just talking about for-profit colleges, though. We'll talk about a much broader view of higher education in Suzanne Mettler's book, Degrees of Inequality, back on the Jefferson Exchange with Suzanne, and your phone calls and emails in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Suzanne Mettler. She's a professor of American institutions at Cornell University, a fellow at the Century Foundation, a think tank. Her book is Degrees of Inequality, How the Politics of Higher Education Sabotage the American Dream. We're talking about a host of issues with higher education in public and private realms across the country. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. One phone number available to you, 800-838-3760. The other phone lines allocated to our fund drive, which we'll be talking about later in the program. Your pledge of support always welcome. You can also email us during the exchange to get your point across at jx@jeffnet.org. So, Suzanne, your basic thesis here appears to be that college once helped upward mobility. Is it having anything like that effect now?
Well, certainly for some individuals, it still enables them to have upward mobility, but it's doing much less of that than it ought to be, particularly at this point in time when a college degree is more important than ever. Too many students go to college and either don't graduate, or if they do, have so much student loan debt relative to the quality of their degree that they end up being even worse off than if they'd never gone to college in the first place. If they're severely indebted, that can happen.
So that they're in that deep of a hole, they can really never climb out of that hole, or just their income will never quite get up to that level?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that's really the problem for many of these students who go to the for-profits, is that they were already working in a very low-paying job. And these tend to be very low-income people who are sought after by the for-profit colleges. But then if they end up without their degree or with a degree that doesn't allow them to get a job, but they have a lot of debt, they're really in a bad situation. So the other thing is that what's happening today is that while we're sending more and more people to college, more start college, when you look at who actually graduates by age 24 with a four-year degree, there's great inequality. So people who grow up in the top quarter of the income distribution, today almost all of them go to college, and by age 24, 71% have received their baccalaureate degree. But the numbers are really not impressive when you look at the bottom three quarters of the income distribution. And for people who grow up in the bottom half of the income distribution, they're not much better than they were back in the 1970s. So for people in the bottom quarter, only 1 in 10 today get a college degree by age 24 and a four-year degree, and in the second quartile, it's 15%. So that's really sobering. And then on top of that, there's the problem of where students attend, because that's almost as important as whether or not you get the diploma is where you got it from, and whether the quality of that institution is really going to make a difference in your life.
All right. Before we focus on the kinds of institutions, I want to go a little further back in the history lesson to the mid-20th century. And the figures you give on the explosion of students going to college are very impressive. I mean, how many more people went to college with federal help from about World War II on, 1940 on, let's say?
Well, it was really impressive. I wrote a book a couple of books ago about the World War II GI Bill. And so here you had all of these veterans coming back after the war, and over half of them used the GI Bill to go on to college or for advanced kind of vocational training. And then that was followed up upon by the Korean War GI Bill and the one for Vietnam veterans. And then meanwhile, we started extending aid to civilians through all sorts of public policies, Higher Education Act of 1965 and Pell Grants and so on. And so we saw in 1940, only 1 in 20 young Americans had a college degree, a four-year college degree. By 1977, that number had grown to 1 in 4. So that's a really dramatic increase. And I can't tell you exactly, you know, the extent to which that growth came from federal student aid. It certainly also came from the investment that the states were making over this period in time when they were really developing their colleges and universities as well. And that really broadened access dramatically.
So, Suzanne, when we talk about the comparisons to other countries and the success or lack thereof of students graduating with college degrees, are we sliding? Are they getting better or both?
We have been just about holding steady to where we were a couple of generations ago in terms of the percentage of young people who get college degrees, whereas we used to be the world leader in college degree attainment. Now there are about 10 other countries that have leapfrogged over us. So they're continuing to make great advances, and we've lost our leadership role in this regard.
Is it an issue of, I mean, obviously there are lots of issues here that you point out, I mean, the expense and all, but are students not as well prepared for college as they once were, or is it they can't afford, or they're just not considering it? I mean, what are some of the factors that come just from the student themselves?
No, actually, high school graduation rates have increased dramatically over time. And, you know, certainly there's a lot of focus today about how we need to improve K-12 education much more, and that's undeniable. But we make a mistake if we think that our poor college graduation rates emanate solely from students' lack of preparedness. If you look at, for example, the test scores that students had on standardized math tests in high school, and then who ends up several years later with a college degree, you find that people who grew up low income with high test scores are just about as likely to get a college degree as those from high income who had low test scores. And what that suggests to me is that it's about much more than preparedness. It's really about finances. And we find survey after survey that reveals this, that students, the reason why they don't continue is because they can't afford the tuition, and often because on top of that, they're spending so much time being employed trying to be able to afford the tuition.
And obviously the focus of the book is on the political end of what got us here. The subtitle, How the Politics of Higher Education Sabotaged the American Dream. And you write that understanding what happened to higher education requires us to put politics front and center. So just by example, we were talking about 1 in 4 students graduating with college degrees in 1977. How did we get from that to the example you cite in the book of Rick Santorum calling President Obama a snob for wanting everybody to go to college?
Well, that's quite a transformation. And what I would say, what I've really learned about this is, for one thing, we have a particular sort of challenge today in governing, and this is true not just in higher education policy, but in lots of policy areas. We have existing policies on the books, all of these landmark laws created many decades ago, and they need to be maintained and they need to be updated to accommodate contemporary circumstances. The problem is that today it's not happening well, and that is because of the direction our political system has taken, particularly with the kind of polarization that I was mentioning earlier, with the two political parties being so polarized. And it's interesting that you should mention Rick Santorum, because a big problem I find in the book is that we used to see higher education being an area where there was real bipartisan support around issues. There were certainly different philosophies in each party about how policies should be developed and administered and so on. But there was agreement that it should happen and that it was important to do so. And therefore, lawmakers were willing to engage in deliberation across the aisle to try to make that possible. And what we're seeing today is so many lawmakers who are really unwilling to engage in that kind of support for higher education policy. So that's part of the problem. It leads to a stalemate. And, you know, I interviewed Senator Nancy Kassebaum, who was from Kansas, moderate Republican, who for a long time was either the chair of the Senate Education and Labor Committee or the ranking member. And she said to me, you know, public programs, like any kind of programs, need to be managed. And she suggested that that's really not happening adequately today. But, you know, she remembers a time when there was bipartisan willingness to do that. And today there's much less of that, which is why we're seeing these sorts of problems around the for-profits and federal student aid and so on.
This is the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Professor Suzanne Mettler from Cornell University. She's the author of the book Degrees of Inequality, How the Politics of Higher Education Sabotage the American Dream. This is a discussion you can join. Our phone number available to you today for discussion, 800-838-3760. If you better get a busy signal, try again. Or you can always send us an email, no impedance there, jx@jeffnet.org. So I'm trying to figure out what. So you mentioned that the Nancy Kassebaum talking about programs needing to be managed. Was it that they got sloppy in their management? Was it that attitudes about them changed?
Well, you know, with any programs over time, they can produce unintended consequences. They can develop in ways that lawmakers did not intend or foresee. And sometimes it's because of their own design features. Sometimes it's because laws actually create an incentive for particular industries, for example, to provide a service. And then those industries become politically mobilized to really push the policy development in a certain direction that benefits them. And that can be at odds with what's best for the American public. You know, an example of that is the for-profit colleges, which time and again have really grown in response to federal student aid and have really sought after those federal student aid dollars. But what we've seen in the past from after the GI Bill after World War II and on up through the late 80s and early 1990s is that lawmakers came together in a bipartisan way to try to enact some regulations to sort of rein in the ability of laws to go off the rails in that regard. And today we're not seeing that happen. Instead, in that particular instance, you see bipartisan support for the industry and ignoring the large problems that are emerging from these schools.
You write that the big fall downs in the higher education system in America are, number one, changes in federal student aid, number two, state government support, number three, the for-profits getting federal aid, which you just addressed. So two of these three major issue areas are basically coming back to Congress. Has there been a reduction in federal student aid? Has it just not kept up? I mean, what has been the trend there over the past 20, 30 years?
Well, the trend during the 1980s and 1990s and up until 2007 was by and large that funding was falling behind, grant funding was falling behind in real terms, and that left students to borrow more through student loans. And it was much easier for lawmakers to say, let's relax the borrowing restrictions and allow more students to borrow more money rather than coming together to increase Pell Grant levels. But ironically, in the past handful of years, particularly since 2007 and actually going a little bit to the late 90s in some ways, we've seen an increase in how much the federal government is spending on student aid. So this means that the plot thickens. It's more complicated to look at what's going wrong. In fact, we're spending a lot of money today in ways that do not really expand access to college or graduation rates effectively. For example, since the late 1990s, we've been doing much more through the tax code. President Bill Clinton was the first to sign into law these tuition tax relief policies, and they've been expanded upon by President George W. Bush, and then quite dramatically by President Obama. And the problem with these policies is that they pretty much just help people who would go to college anyway. They don't really encourage people who are thinking about it but don't know if they can afford it. They don't help them to make the decision to go because they're administered long after tuition is paid. You get the money back through the tax system. So there's that problem. There's also the fact that we're now spending 1 in 4 federal student aid dollars on the for-profit colleges, despite the fact that it's only 1 in 10 students who attend them and they produce such poor outcomes for students. So those are some of the problems with federal student aid today.
You lay a lot of these changes back to Ronald Reagan's presidency and obviously the compliance of Congress. It's interesting, though, you cite Senator Phil Graham of Texas at the time as one of the major backers. Wasn't he a college professor himself?
Oh, actually, I don't know that.
I know he's an economist. I don't know if he actually worked at a university, though. But I don't know. Anyway, an educated man himself. So I'm just trying to figure out how educated people decide that the people behind them don't get the same sorts of benefits of education they had.
Well, actually, with Senator Phil Graham, along with Bob Dole, had been proponents of trying to regulate the for-profit colleges. So, in that regard, they were certainly trying to do something that would make the federal government more responsible in terms of how it was allocating federal student aid dollars in trying to ensure better outcomes for students. But I think, it is a problem today that that lawmakers in the positions they're taking are not always thinking about, the next generation. And they, in doing things like defending the for-profits, I don't think it's where they would want their own children or grandchildren attending.
So the for-profits, if they're getting, 1 in 10 students and then 1 in 4 of the federal student aid dollars, is their success based on aggressive marketing? Is that the largest part of it?
Well, the way that they get their students is, yes, through aggressive marketing. They invest much of their money into marketing, much less so on a percentage basis than what traditional colleges and universities do. And they spend much less on actual instruction and education. But then the question of why they're so effective, the answer, I would say, is that they've become so politically influential. And they do that in interesting ways. They certainly spend a fair amount of money on campaign contributions and lobbying. I found when I looked at this closely that they're very strategic about the sort of lobbying they do. Because of partisan polarization, this actually makes political influence easier in some ways for interest groups. And in their case, they've managed to get the entire Republican Party on Capitol Hill lined up in their defense, which is a big change from the past, when as recently as the Reagan administration and George H.W. Bush administration, there were many Republicans who saw the for-profit industry as one that was really mooching off the federal government, and they disapproved of it. Now they all line up in its support. So then what the industry has been able to do is to focus on getting the Democrats on its side. And it's done that by hiring former Democratic lawmakers, such as Representative Dick Gephardt of Missouri, for example, and others who worked for Democrats on Capitol Hill as their staffers. It's hired these people as its lobbyists, and through their social networks, they managed to get plenty of Democratic support in the U.S. House of Representatives.
We have an email here from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. He writes, for-profit colleges on the federal trough equal our money. Why should for-profit colleges be any better than the healthcare industry or defense? They get all our money for record earnings. And isn't it curious that more education, more college grads than ever, buys less in terms of wages, standard of living, job security, etc., which is essentially the essence of your book?
Well, actually, so I agree with the writer on the first point that the for-profit industry is one that is really feeding at the federal trough. And I think this is a great concern to taxpayers and also to the students who they deserve so much and whose lives they can put at financial ruin. But I do want to speak to the last statement. I would say that in the media today and somewhat from public officials, the impression is being given that a college degree is not worth it anymore. And that would be a gross overstatement. What really matters is what sector of higher education a student attends and which particular institution they attend.
All right, much more to talk about on that. We have to get to the other side of a break. Suzanne Mettler's our guest. Her book is Degrees of Inequality. We'll resume the discussion with her and take your phone calls and emails when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Cornell University professor Suzanne Mettler. She is the author of a book called Degrees of Inequality, How the Politics of Higher Education Sabotage the American Dream, and it documents decades of change from the post-GI Bill landscape in which one in four American students, one in four American young people got college degrees to where we're now at a much lower number, one in ten. You can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange. Our operating phone line today at 800-838-3760. We've reallocated the others for our spring fund drive. We'll talk about that later. Again, 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So, Suzanne, you were saying you were resisting the idea that some people say that a college degree is not worth the money these days. It is, depending on where you go to, you were saying.
Yes. And if you look at the data, college degree recipients are still much better off than those who don't go to college and who have only a high school degree. And four-year graduates have better outcomes than two-year graduates. If you look at the income data, the employment data, this is very clear. So I think what happened was that starting in 2008 with the economic downturn, there were lots of stories about unemployed college graduates, and there are certainly more than there were before the downturn. And yet, when you compare their unemployment rates to people who don't have a college degree, there's no comparison. And in terms of the incomes that people receive, you know, after leaving college, the average college graduate's getting $40,000 a year compared to $25,000 a year for a high school graduate. And in terms of all sorts of other outcomes, it's just a dramatic difference.
We did get a chance to check, by the way. I was not trying to play stump the guest there, but Phil Graham did, in fact, teach economics at Texas A&M from 1967 to 1978. So a college professor himself who was responsible for some of the changes made congressionally to the landscape of what's available to students today. Want to talk about you talked about the three major problems with higher education in America, the changes to federal student aid, the for-profits getting a lot of federal aid, 90% of their revenue or 86% of their revenue comes from federal aid for the for-profit colleges. But we haven't talked much about the state government support. And this is a story well known in Oregon and California, where both states have seen major cuts in state support from the general fund for the higher education institutions, fewer program offerings as a result, and tuition zooming over the years. But we're not alone, it sounds like. Much of the country has seen this as well.
That's right. This is a huge national trend, and it's a very important piece of this whole puzzle. 73% of American college students still attend public universities and colleges, but those colleges nationwide, on average, have seen a reduction of 26% per student from the state governments. And as a result, what they've had to do is charge more tuition instead in order to be able to balance the books. And so tuition has gone up, and this is from 1990 to 2010, tuition has gone up by 113%. In addition, these public universities and colleges have had to squeeze resources in other ways, and they've done that by crowding more students into the classroom, by making more classes taught online because that's a cost savings, often by adjunct professors, and by reducing student support services. And it turns out that all of these things are detrimental to college graduation rates. There's the financial component that with higher tuition makes it harder for students to stay enrolled. And then with the reduction of the student services and more students in the classroom, these are really disadvantageous for those students who come from less privileged backgrounds and really need more interaction with professors in order to be able to graduate. So those things are really hurting us in a big way.
Both California and Oregon can point to changes in tax structure. Both states went through major property tax limitation measures, Prop 13 in California in the late 70s and Measure 5 in Oregon in 1990, which is the first year you cited in that string of years there. But that's not the same case in other states. The tax structures haven't necessarily changed, but is it often a get tough on crime thing where they're spending more money on prisons and therefore less on higher ed?
Yes, the general trends across the states is that there has been a dramatic increase in other areas of spending, such as the cost of Medicaid, K-12 education, and incarceration, because all of those things have increased nationwide, and some of them in some states worse than others. But the problem is that all of those are mandatory forms of spending, whereas higher education is discretionary. So if state lawmakers are trying to find somewhere to get the dollars they need for these other areas of spending, higher ed is the first to go because it's the largest area of discretionary spending. But the other problem, which you're highlighting, is a revenue problem. And I found in the analysis I did that states that have been willing to raise revenues have not faced these trade-offs between these different kinds of spending. But many states really have their hands tied now about raising revenues because of policies they've adopted since the 1970s that in many states it's now part of the Constitution that they can't raise revenues without going to the voters in a referendum, which turns out to be a really difficult way to run fiscal policy for states. And so it's that crunch of more spending commitments in other areas and less revenue that's really leaving higher ed to pay the price.
Well, it's not like the people who run the states are unaware of this, and there are examples in your book of states becoming aware and addressing this. But what happened, for example, with Governor Zell Miller's HOPE program in Georgia?
Oh, yes, the HOPE program. There are many programs that have been started by states, and many of them are in the South, that actually end up having the effect of doing more for higher-income students than they do for low- to middle-income students. So these programs that enable, say, you know, the valedictorian of every high school or students who have particularly great scores to go to college for free or with large amounts of merit aid, that's disadvantageous to spending that could really help most students to be able to go to college, because we find, you know, there's a very high correlation between things like SAT scores, for example, and income. And so we're spending, it's another example of how we're spending more money on higher ed, but not in ways that really help most Americans.
The book, again, is called Degrees of Inequality, How the Politics of Higher Education Sabotage the American Dream. Suzanne Mettler, we've dealt mostly with federal and state issues, but higher education at the private level as well. I mean, the Harvards and Yales of the world also seem to be charging a lot more money over the years. And how do we account for that boost? That can't be quite as politically driven as the other stuff we're talking about.
Well, certainly the nonprofit private universities and colleges have the highest average sticker price or published tuition prices compared to the other sectors. It is somewhat deceiving because many of these schools give a considerable amount of financial aid. Sometimes it's more merit aid, sometimes it's more need-based aid. But the average student is paying something around 50% of the published tuition price at most of these nonprofit privates these days. And so you really need to look below the surface to see what's happening. Now, some schools are actually going quite far to try to help low-income students that they take in, and they recruit them actively. They have a large percentage of students who are on Pell Grants, and they actually give them additional money to help them to really get through so they can graduate. But then there are other schools that have been in this race that is really engendered by the U.S. News and World Report rankings, where they're trying to improve their status in terms of the percentage of students with high SAT scores and the like. And so they spend more of their own funds on merit aid rather than assisting those students who are from the lower parts of the income distribution. So one of the things that I recommend in the book is that the federal government, because it gives so much money to these schools as well as to public universities and colleges, it needs to require all of these institutions to be full players and partners in trying to expand opportunity. And they really need to be committed to that.
So these are things that you advocate happening. But, I mean, for the person who may be late in high school, or for the parents who are looking at their kids coming into college in the years ahead, what are some of the things that they can be doing to try to effect change in the system to make it more affordable?
Well, I think that this has really been the missing piece, that we need to hear from the American public on these issues, that lawmakers really need to hear from them. It's an area where, you know, there are trade associations in Washington that represent the universities and colleges, and they can speak to their issues. And those sometimes overlap with what's good for Americans generally, but they're not the same thing. And so I think that part of the challenge here is to for people to really communicate to their elected officials about the need to address these higher ed issues.
Which comes back to the larger point, which is that things changed over the years, and it wasn't like a whole lot was said about them, and all of a sudden we now see the results of what changed in Congress over that period of time. The book is called Degrees of Inequality, How the Politics of Higher Education Sabotage the American Dream. Suzanne Mettler is a professor at Cornell, and she wrote it. And Suzanne, thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, I've really enjoyed being with you. Thank you so much, Jeff.
It's good to have you.